This morning, our speaker for the next hour handed me a slip of paper, and on the slip of paper was his name and his subject. And I read it, and I said to him, "How do you want me to announce this?" And he said, with a long pause in between. So I want to tell you that our next speaker is Brother David Duran. He's a brother who has served us with many interesting and very thought-provoking discourses in the past, and we would expect nothing less this afternoon. On the slip of paper, it said, "Brother David Duran, the root of all evil." And so I give you our Brother David.
Let's hope not. Very, very nice to be here. And the brethren in the Louisville area who couldn't be here, do send their love in Christ to you. You know the text. It's in 1 Timothy 6:10. You don't even have to bother looking at it. That the love of money is the root of all evil. I'm using that text as a title, but I'm not looking at that Timothy text as it's written. It's written probably for individual application, and there are many wonderful lessons in it. But I'm going to look at it in a sense of a prophetic interpretation instead, something with a much larger scale, that the love of money is and has been the root of all evil. So this is not going to be about us individually, it's going to be about us collectively and about history collectively. We are going to look at prophecy, not in detail today. We'll look at some just big overall views, because it's so important sometimes to see big pictures rather than little ones. At a convention last year, somebody said, "I bet the topic's going to be on Revelation." It made me think that I talk about Revelation too much. But this is a big book. It goes back a long time. And we're near the end. We ought to be reading the last chapter. There isn't much time left, so we really have to find out how it ends. One little note about the interpretation of prophecy, because brethren get in trouble over it, probably constantly will. But prophecy is written not so much because of the effect it's going to have on you or me personally. Prophecy is written to show the trend of a period of time. You know the text. Is it up here? Yes. The devil will cast some of you in prison for 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and you will get the crown of life. First of all, the thing about that prophecy you want to notice is it said some. It didn't say all. And if any period of the church has been the most persecuted, it's been that second period of the church. But there were brethren then. There were ecclesias then scattered about that saw relatively little persecution. And if you were to ask them personally, "Does this Revelation 2:10 apply to your day?" they'd say, "Nah, no way. Couldn't possibly." Because their experience was not what Revelation 2:10 said. But if you ask the brother who had to be in the Colosseum being fed to lions, or the one who was dipped in tar and tied to a post and lit at night so the streets had lights, he'd say, "Yes, I think it did." But we don't interpret prophecy by how it affects you or me. There are brethren who think they're going to die on their front porch in a rocking chair, And maybe they will. And there are brethren who think they're going to die because the Pope himself is going to pour hot lead in their ears. And maybe he will. But the chances are most of us are going to die from a heart attack or cancer or an airplane accident or falling down the stairs. Nevertheless, when we look at prophecy in our day, maybe I shouldn't say nevertheless. Therefore, when we look at prophecy in our day, don't open the door and say, I didn't get hit this morning, therefore prophecy about getting hit in the morning doesn't apply to me, or it doesn't apply now. Prophecy applies to the trend of events for a certain period of the church. With that in mind, let's do some review. Over the years, I have heard, you have probably heard, maybe you've even been among those who have, worried about communism. Brother Russell, of course, did not worry about communism. Brother Russell said the threat, the real threat to peace and security, not only for the church and the world, would come from the right wing, not from the left. And brethren forgot that over the years as they looked out the door and said, well, communism must be doing something. And that's our problem again. We look and see what's happening and we think, well, I don't care what the scripture says, my eye sees this. But it should be the other way around. I don't care what my eye sees. The scripture says this. And the scriptures tend to lend credence to the thought that the problem the world will experience at its closing moments is from the right wing and not from the left. So Brother Russell's vindicated again as communism is seeing largely a collapse. Even now, all of us rejoice in the somewhat victory of people in Eastern Europe over the oppression they have been experiencing. The whole world is rejoicing over the concept of the free market concept for Eastern Europe. Now, this is going to focus in on what we're going to look at prophetically. We want to make some differentiations as we go along, and some things need interpretation. Most people think the opposite of communism is capitalism. And you have been hoodwinked by common usage if you think that that's the case. Capitalism came into existence somewhere in the Renaissance period of history, 1400s roughly. It is not the same as a free market. A free market is where you are free to do what you want. Like when this country was young and Paul Revere made silver and somebody else made harnesses for horses and somebody else repaired things, somebody made ships. They all did it just fine. That's free market. It's a wonderful idea under the present distress until the millennium takes over. Free market concept is at the root of why the United States grew economically over the centuries. Capitalism is not at the root of it. Capitalism is a great evil. As great an evil as communism is, and prophetically, a greater evil. Now, I'm not defending communism, and I am not knocking the free market system upon which the West has been made free and strong to allow us to have the religious freedoms we do. I'm trying to make a differentiation which is important prophetically. Capitalism is not the free market system. Capitalism is where money is used to do one thing and one thing only. That's make more money. Paul Revere made silver. Somebody else made ships. Capitalists make money. Now, they may have to put a product in there to cover the fact that they're not doing anything useful. But they have one objective and one objective only. To make money from money. Hence our text. The love of money is the root of all evil. Not just individually, but prophetically. Let's look at the large historical picture of Christianity in some big chunks. We're going to take four periods of time, 300 to 1800 first. Actually, we should say 1799, but I'm rounding everything off. 1800 to 1914. I won't round that off. That's too good a date. 1914 to about 1980. In the last decade. Let's see what's happened. From 300 to 1800, papacy was the holder of the bag. Gradually at first, more securely at the end. Only papacy and Judas have the honor of being called scripturally the son of perdition, the son of destruction. And both of them were the holders of the bag, the treasurers of the world. And during that time, everything economical in the Western world was under the control of papacy. I know you think of papacy as a religious system. On the surface, it is. Just like some companies make automobiles, when really what they're out to do is make money. Papacy was out for power and money. That's all. Not religion. It's important to remember that. Just as Judas was, it was the holder of the bag from its slow beginnings about 300 to its loss of control about 1800. Money was behind it all. From 1800 to about 1914, the world experienced the opening of the Industrial Revolution in its fullest sense. During this time, we had the flourishing of capitalism. Capitalism is responsible for the fact that you have mortgages on your homes. There was a time, and maybe some of you are old enough to remember it, when people built homes with their neighbors' help, and they never would have thought of not having it paid for. It was paid for when it was built. But somebody got the grand idea to sell you an idea that would be much better if you made it a little bit better, a little bit more expensive, and they'll pay for it. They'll pay for it. And you just give it back to them, dribble at a time. And so this house, which ostensibly in materials costs $20,000, by the time you pay them back for it, costs $120,000 for you. And the extra $100,000 is in their pockets. From 1800 to 1914, capitalism was so much in control that Brother Russell wrote a whole volume about it, the fourth volume. That's why all those numbers are in there about these trusts, about the monopolies, where earnings were beyond the imagination, the desire of anybody who could even think about money. That's the point of the fourth volume, is to show you the rise of capitalism and that it's going to have an effect in the long range of prophecy. The free market started to suffer. 1914 till about 1980, things started changing. The Lord turned down the capitalism burner a little bit. You may not think so, because capitalism is kind of obvious in the world. But some things started happening. Number one, income tax came in that year. And people who made money had to start giving the government part of it. Terrible blow. Antitrust legislation started coming in. Strong unionism started coming in. And communism started spreading. Communism was a terrible enemy of capitalism. A terrible enemy. If there's any spread of hatred for the communist system in this world, it's because it was hurting capitalism. That's the main reason that all of the promotional materials came out against communism. Not that it didn't have other bad factors. But capitalism was hurting. Then comes about 1980, the last decade. I want to review a few things that have been happening since then, because there is a change occurring. There's a change occurring that is bringing capitalism to the forefront again and beginning to squash those controls that had held it down. We are having a rise of capitalism again. First of all, Mr. Reagan's reversals of the taxation system, which in essence relieved the wealthy of most of their tax burdens. I think you've heard Mr. Bush asking for that to be done more. He calls it the repeal of the capital gains tax. And no matter what kind of honey they spread on it, it's all saying the same thing. It is saying, let capitalism have its profits. Don't take them away. During the 80s, social spending stopped to a great degree. Union smashing occurred to a great degree, so that 10 years ago, while unions were strong, today they're exceptionally weak. Probably all started, and I'm not saying anything about Ronald Reagan, he just happened to be the Lord's tool in the system, but it probably all started with the airline, what are they called? Air traffic controllers, thank you. There probably was a smashing blow on the union system. Then came deregulation. You know what deregulation is. It says, don't give me rules. Let me do it the way I want to. And who's it for? It's for big business. You've heard about Maggie Thatcher's poll tax in England. Very unpopular. Whether you happen to live in a great estate or you live in a little hovel, you pay the same amount of tax. So you know who that hurts. And then what you couldn't miss last year was the decline and fall of the communist bloc. Interestingly enough, I think, it's mostly the formerly Christian communist bloc that fell. China, Vietnam, North Korea, those aren't falling. Mostly those countries that used to be in the Christian bloc of nations and became communist, that's where communism is falling. And then there is the rise also of what was known as the EEC, the European Economic Community. They've dropped the middle word, economic. They now call it the European Community. Why did they drop the middle word? Not because it isn't economic. It is. It's entirely based on money. That's what it's there for. But they took that word out so that it doesn't bother you. And if we just call it the European Community, it sounds nice, like the United States of America. I mean, what would it be like if we called it the United States of Economic America? But that's what the European Community is for. Money. The right wing of human endeavor. The few controlling the masses through economic means. It's throughout prophecy. All right, that's our summary. The last 10 years has seen a dramatic turn in the direction things are taking, which may bring to your mind a text. This text was forced to my attention a number of times. It's in Isaiah. Over the past 2 years, first of all, I received a copy of an article from the Wall Street Journal that someone sent me, talking about Gorbachev and the 70-year history of communism in Russia. Then I was watching not too long ago a newscast showing the Supreme Soviet with the leader standing up there, and there are thousands of legislators who know only one word, da, never and yet, always da, whatever the leader says. But there behind him on this huge red background, I can't read Russian, but numbers I can read, 70 years of communism in Russia. It kept striking me. Isaiah 23. Starting verse 15. Now it will come about in that day that Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years. think Tyre here represents Babylon, primarily the Roman church and its influence. Tyre will be forgotten for a period of 70 years, like the days of one king, not one man. Apparently, the word here means something more like dynasty than one individual. So it is saying, it will come to pass in that day that Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one dynasty. What dynasty? What dynasty has lasted for 70 years? Communism. There's the reason that Tyre has been forgotten, because in all of Eastern Europe, it lost its influence. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre, as in the Song of the Harlot, "Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot, pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered." And it will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. "Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth." You cannot have missed the moment the Iron Curtain rusted. Who was the first frequent visitor? It was the Pope. You cannot have but noticed that Mr. Gorbachev went to the Vatican. Strange. Strange. I'm sure he didn't go in and say, "What can I do for you, Your Excellency?" No. He said, "I know what you can do for me." The strangest thing has happened. The strangest thing has happened, but it seems to just so help prophecy as to be almost unimaginably inventive. The Lord invented something before we did. You've heard about freeze-drying things. All you have to do is add water and they're normal again, the coffee and certain kinds of foods. The Lord freeze-dried Christianity, Catholicism, in Eastern Europe. After 1914, there it was. It was frozen. It was inactive. Last year, the water got poured back on it. And when you see the demonstrations of those against communism in their various countries, where do they all start? They start in a church someplace. They end up in a church someplace. And there's always the prelate, the local prelate there, to aid them in helping to tear down communism. Christianity was frozen, deep frozen, for 70 years in Eastern Europe. And the water's been poured back on it. And Catholicism, exactly as it existed in 1914, now exists back in Poland again, back in Czechoslovakia again, probably shortly back in parts of Russia, and in all those other countries along the fringe there, East Germany, etc. It's a remarkable thing to see. It's like turning your television back 70 years before they had television, and there it is. You have Christianity just as it was 70 years ago. I think Isaiah 23 is being fulfilled right in the midst of our faces. The Communist Revolution, of course, happened at the end of the First World War. Roughly the period 1914 to 1919 is when it happened. If you add 70 years to that, I'm not pinpointing any particular date, but if you add 70 years to that period, you come up with 1984 to 89, which is roughly when it fell apart. If you want to be more specific, fine. Pick which date you like. The fact is, 70 years is important in the Communist Revolution. They recognize it. I think we should also. Now, let's look to the book of Revelation. Revelation 12 through 19, you might call the rise and fall of the papal apostasy. and we can learn a great deal from it. I am not going to go into a great deal. I want to look at some large overviews of these particular chapters just so we see where they're going, how papacy came up, how it's going down again. And I think we can link it to the moneyed movements in the world today. Chapter 12 of Revelation, verses 5 and 6. She gave birth to a son, was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness that she might be nourished for 1,260 days. You've got the growth of papacy, the true church having to flee from its influence. Verse 13. When the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Very important verse. Dragon is civil power. Papacy has always exercised its influence through civil power. So this chapter is not only identifying the fact that this Roman church would ascend, so the church would have to flee from it, but that its ascendancy would be with civil power behind it. Chapter 13:1 is really the end of chapter 12. So chapter 12 ends by saying, "And he stood on the sand of the seashore." That's the dragon. That's how chapter 13 really ends. The dragon is standing on the sands of the seashore. The civil power relies on authority and money. It's the only two things that let it flourish. They don't care what the people think. That's immaterial. They rely on authority, which is hoodwinking the people, to making the people think that they're doing well, and on money. And that's it. And the dragon stands on the seashore. And you know what the seashore is, the sands of the sea, the multitude of mankind. Chapter 13, I think, is here to show us that this apostasy will have civil power and is also being joined by others. It will not be exclusive. In other words, this critter which occurs in chapter 12, which we call papacy or Babylon, will have friends. And chapter 13 is there to show us that additional feature. Chapter 13 really ends with the fifth verse of chapter 14. You kind of miss the picture if you don't see that. Because in essence, chapter 13 is ending by saying some people are going to have the mark of the beast in their hands or their forehead, but some others are going to have the name of the Lord in their forehead, and that's the important ones. Those are the ones that are going to end up reigning. So all that is one picture which goes on through 14:5. I won't even read in chapter 13. Chapter 14, verse 8, another angel, second one, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." So we're getting toward the end of the picture here where some threat exists for this Babylon which has arisen. Arisen isn't even a word. Verses 10 and 12. "He will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, tormented with fire and brimstone. The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever," showing you, I think, a slow destruction of that papal system. Keep that in mind. It's going to come up later in Revelation, particularly this burning factor. And when we get to verse 12, here is the perseverance of the saints. And here has been the perseverance of the saints, because this Babylon is fallen, you know, it was an 1878 date. And you've been trying to persevere ever since then. You've been looking at prophecy, you've been looking at events, you've been looking for the kingdom in its fullest sense, and a lot of brethren have died not seeing it. And some brethren's faith have been shaken because they threw a date here and they threw a date there and it didn't work. Or they tied too much to a date that did work. Here is the patience or perseverance of the saints. The Revelator is saying, you're going to wait a long time. You're going to wait from 1878 through this whole slow burning of Babylon. over decades and decades. Chapter 14 ends with the destruction. The winepress was trodden outside the city. And I'm just mentioning that because it suggests that the destruction of this Babylonian system is not going to be in her own backyard. The city seems to represent Christendom. But the destruction of Christendom itself is outside the city. And of course, you all probably have an inkling of what that means. We expect Babylon to meet its destruction because of events not in Christendom, but because of events in Israel. And the winepress will be trodden outside the city. It is events in Israel that's going to squeeze the life out of this foul apostasy that grew up. Chapter 15. Actually, 15 and 16 are sort of one chapter. Verse 1 of 15. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels who had seven plagues, which are the last, because in them the wrath of God is finished. Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful message for the church. The wrath of God finished. Done. No more wrath. That should excite you. That's one of the most wonderful verses in the whole book of Revelation. These are the last plagues. Why are they the last? Because when they're over, God's wrath is done. When these plagues are finished, no more wrath. So even though these plagues deal with destruction, what a welcome destruction. When the wrath is, when the plagues are gone, the wrath is gone, and that's why they're called the last plagues. Verse 5, after these things I looked, and the temple of the tabernacle of testimony in heaven was opened. And I think contemporaneously, with this period of time when the judgment on Babylon begins, something else begins. The Most Holy is thrown open in many senses. First of all, in Brother Russell's day, it was thrown open because you could look inside and you could see the Ark of the Covenant. You understood the New Covenant concept. What a marvelous thing for the church to experience. Something been lost sight of so long. But here, the temple of the tabernacle, the Most Holy, is thrown open and there sits the covenant. Unfortunately, verse 8, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power, and nobody was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues were finished. So even though you see that new covenant, you want it so badly, nobody can minister it. No new covenant until the seven plagues are gone. So it's a wonderful time. It's a wonderful time. It's perseverance and patience for the saints, but it's understanding the new covenant, anticipating it. But it's also waiting until those plagues are done so that that Most Holy can be entered and the blessings of the new covenant can be thrown out and shared with the whole world of mankind. Chapter 16 goes over the details of this period, over the period that was called the patience of the saints in chapter 14. In verse 13 of chapter 16, I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs, the spirits of demons, performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God Almighty. I suspect we're just about ready to see that. Just about ready. But remember those three entities. Dragon, civil power. Beast, the Roman apostasy, and false prophet. One of those things that occurred in chapter 13 we didn't even read about. The fact that the beast is not alone, somebody else with him. Chapter 17. I love the opening to this chapter. Marvelous chapter. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying... This is the first time this happens in the book of Revelation. This character steps aside. One of the seven that had these plagues. I really think this is Brother Russell. I think that can be demonstrated from the scriptures if you take the time, which we don't have.
This angel, which had one of the seven last plagues, steps aside and talks to us, to the John class, and explains things to come, which was one of Brother Russell's functions. And he says, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." That's what you want to know about, isn't it? How is this woman going to be judged? Verse 8. "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come." I know that sounds like a crossword puzzle, but in essence, it seems to be referring to the fact that this, quote, beast, unquote, had once in the past come out, done its damage, and gone back into hiding, so to speak. And I think it's referring to chapter 11, verse 7, which I won't read. When the people in France revolted against Christianity, tore down. It was illegal to have religion in France, the openings of the French Revolution. And so the beast, which seems to be referred to, is in essence a revolution of the people as a unit. Verse 12, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, and have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. When this beast, this amassing of people who ultimately are going to hate something about Christianity, when this comes about, it says there are 10 kings that have some kind of authority with them. For many years, it was very difficult to see what the mechanism of that might be. But now it seems, and I stress the seems, I'm not a prophet, just a student of prophecy. It seems that is the existing nations of Europe, which we now call the European, and I'll keep the word in the middle, economic community. I think that's what this is talking about. A Europe reunited for economic reasons, having similar aims and ends to a body of people that will come into power at that given time in the not too far distant future. Verse 16, "And the 10 horns which you saw," I think the European Economic Community, "and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire." What a horrible end, but what a wonderful end, depending on your perspective. So the angel is telling us in chapter 17 how the apostate church is going to meet an end. It's going to meet an end because an economic community and the people with it are going to say, "Stop, this is enough, you've poked your nose in here once too often, get out." And when they won't get out, they'll burn her with fire and they'll eat her flesh and she won't be left. Which suggests to me, and this could totally be wrong, but it suggests to me that most of the Pope's influence is going to be in Eastern Europe, where he's poking his nose at the moment. And there will be some sort of problem between the economic community of Western Europe, which wants to attain certain economic ends, and the economics of Eastern Europe, which obviously aren't even developed yet, but want to be developed. There's a terrible struggle here. You know, Germany is having it in their uniting plans. What are we going to do economically? We've got two economic systems going here. The biggest problem in Germany is the mark. It's not reuniting the country. It's what are we going to do with the mark? It's always the dollar. It's the root of all evil, the love of it. And that would suggest that this will be the catalyst between a pope who is poking his nose into Europe, and you know, if you watch any news whatsoever, you know those people still worship that awful system. You look at it and you see it on their faces and they just glow when they see that imposter come to town. They've been in cold storage for 70 years, and they're welcoming that harlot with open arms. It's a great day to watch. There are finally catalysts at work in the earth that seem like they may be the things that could fulfill these prophecies. I'm being very hesitant. I'm not saying it's going to happen this way. But finally, we can see things that can be the fulfillments. Let's look at chapter 18. Chapter 18 of Revelation, for a long time, has been the one that has given me the most problems. Probably because I wanted to interpret every single word of those long lists of things. Sounds like a grocery list. And I guess I wanted to somehow spiritualize them all. And it finally struck me, that's not at all what this is trying to say. Let's look at what's happening here. 18:2. He cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become the dwelling place of demons, the prison of every unclean spirit, and the prison of every unclean and hateful bird." That's there to date it. Remember, we found that expression back in chapter 14. It's to give us a date, 1878. Verse 4, another voice from heaven, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins and that you may not receive of her plagues." So the plagues apparently follow this date, that long patience of the saint period. So we're dating at 1878. The rest of the chapter, or the midsection of the chapter, has four clearly defined groups in it. Four clearly defined groups. Three of them on one side of the platform here, and the other one totally on the other side of the platform. Verses 9 and 10. Well, let me show you where they are first. The first group, verse 9, kings of the earth. Second group, verse 11, merchants of the earth, which I'm just going to call capitalists. Verse 17, every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor. I'm going to call that the workers and profiteers in the capitalist system or under the capitalists. And verse 20, the saints. That's the other group. So I think what we have here listed between verse 9 and verse 21 is a reaction to the ongoing plagues that start somewhere after 1878 and end when the wrath of God is filled up. And we have the reactions of these three groups of people with an admonition to the fourth group. Notice their reactions. Verse 9, the kings of the earth who have committed acts of immorality and live sensuously with her, primarily political leaders, I suspect, stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, that great city Babylon, the strong city." And here's why they say, "Woe." For in 1 hour, your judgment has come. That's the word, right there. Judgment. That's why they are afraid. That's why they are saying, "Woe, woe." Because they are looking at this system and saying, "You're being judged." And their reaction is, "Uh-oh, what about me? Am I going to be judged too? Because I've been with you all this time." The leaders, political, strong leaders of the world, have always been in the same position Babylon has been, at the top. And so as they look at Babylon losing power, they're saying, "Oh my, in this 1 hour is my judgment also, my decline occurring." Verse 11, the merchants of the earth, the capitalists, weep and mourn over her. Then there's a long shopping list. A very international shopping list, by the way. And I think that's the point of that list. It's to show you this is not about one country. This is about the interaction of capitalism around the world. Places where there is ivory, where there is citron wood, where there is gold, where there is iron, where there is marble, where there is cinnamon and spice, where there are human slaves. Doesn't matter, but they're all different places, showing the international quality of this capitalist trade. Remember, the product of capitalism is the dollar. This shopping list has nothing to do with anything, except without it, they can't get the dollar. And it's dependent on an international relationship, which communism destroyed because it took the whole eastern end of Europe out of this equation. So why do these people mourn? Verse 17, in 1 hour such great wealth have been laid waste. They aren't worried about judgment. Capitalism couldn't care less about judgment. They figure if they have a dollar in the bank, who cares what the judge says? But when they look at Eastern Europe, for 70 years such great wealth has been laid waste. Capitalism couldn't do anything there. They lost their dollar. Of course they're mourning. You know, the prophecy or the admonition is the love of money is the root of all evil. Is communism the love of money? No, never claimed to be. Must not be. They don't have any. Capitalism is the love of money. And they're the ones that say, oh my, in 1 hour such great wealth hath been laid waste. Group 4, verse 17. Every shipmaster, passenger, and sailor, everybody that's lived under this capitalist international economic way of life. Why do they say woe? End of verse 19. Woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. The capitalist said the wealth has been laid waste. Those that work say she's been laid waste. My employer doesn't have any money anymore. I'm not getting a paycheck. Because all the people in this third class live from month to month. And they rely on that money trickling down through this capitalist system to keep them going to pay their mortgage. And so they can look at what's happening and say, oh my, she is being laid waste. But our reaction over the last 70 years to that patience of the saints verse that chapter 14 said is in verse 20. Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. So we can rejoice as we see things falling apart, particularly economically, because economics are the key. It's not religion. It's not politics. It's the buck. Then the summary comes in chapter 18. And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea. Now, I think the taking up is important. I think papacy is riding a high right now, or at least she thinks she is. Being lifted up and saying, oh, look at this, I'm getting all these millions of Catholics back. And they're just the way they were 70 years ago. They're not even Baptists. They haven't changed a whit. She's riding a high, and she's probably going to get a little bit higher yet. But this doesn't make it a very good ride here. This millstone's being picked up for one reason and one reason only, to be thrown into the sea. And the angel says, thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. And then all of the things that used to happen in her will not happen any longer. Perfect timing. Just like prophecy is. Chapter 19, simply says the same thing over again in a different way. In verse 11, you see the Lord as the warrior behind the whole destruction. Verse 19, I saw the beast. Now, this is the beast of chapter 16, beast, dragon, and false prophet. This is not the beast of chapter 17 that came up out of the abyss. There's lots of beasts going around. Have to keep these beasts separate here. This is the beast of chapter 16. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet. There's two of those three things that occurred in the plagues, remember? Beast, dragon, and false prophet. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. And that's the end of the apostasy. Thank God. But of course, if you're a student of Revelation, you don't breathe that final sigh of relief, because you remember there weren't two, there were three. There wasn't just the beast and the false prophet, there was the dragon. But the dragon, you see, in chapter 20 gets thrown in the hole for 1,000 years and gets put in where the beast and false prophet are 1,000 years later. So he gets his also. It's just delayed action because he's needed at the end of the story. All right, that's it. No more. Our whole point here was to say we finally have in world events of today a mechanism by which the thrust of the prophecy can be fulfilled. That papacy, the right wing of American, of human political social experience, is going to have a final run-in with the moneyed interests, which will create her destruction. Whatever we suffer from it individually is immaterial. The thrust of prophecy is to say this is the way it's going to happen. It is happening. We can rejoice. May the Lord add His blessing.
Just as we had expected, some very thought-provoking ideas from our brother David Duran on how money will, as the root of all evil, tie in with the events of the near future. Thank you, Brother David, for stimulating our minds with those thoughts. Brother David will lead us in prayer.
Our holy and gracious Father, please continue with Thy grace. Let it rule our lives. Help us to emulate Thee and Thy Son. Help us to bless one another. Help us to be made ready internally that we might hear Thy well done and share the blessing of being blessers. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.